you looking to satisfy your inner econ geek? Well, stay tuned, because we're having a roundtable on economic and monetary theory, money, employment, and all things post-Keynesian. Yes! You know about post-Keynesian economics, right? If you don't, or maybe you're a little rusty, here's a perfect refresher course coming up. I'm Jabalani LaFaul, and on today's Central Standard, we're joined by distinguished UMKC research professors, the local economic outlaws who are appearing at the International Post-Keynesian Conference this weekend. Find out why the dynamics of the private sector are essential to understanding the economy. Plus, we'll discuss government transparency and accountability. If you have no idea what I just said, tune in. We'll simplify it for you. That's on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. Noted economist John Maynard Keynes, in his book, A Tract on Monetary Reform, probably laid out his most enduring economic forecast when he said, in the long run, we're all dead. Aside from that, there are some practical economic lessons we can learn from him, and some of the most ardent practitioners of post-Keynesian economic theory are right here in Kansas City. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFaul. The University of Missouri, Kansas City's Department of Economics will host the 11th International Post-Keynesian Conference titled Reclaiming the Keynesian Revolution, beginning September 27th through Saturday, September 29th at the Downtown Marriott in Kansas City. And joining us now are our UMKC professors of economics, or economic outlaws, Bill Black, Randall Ray, and Michael Hudson. Welcome to the show. Thank you. Somebody tell me what post-Keynesian Keynesianism is.
Well, I can start.
Randall Ray, you start.
Post means after Keynes.
Right.
Of course, in a sense, we're all after Keynes because he died in 1946. But these are followers of Keynes, and they wanted to distinguish themselves from what is normally taught in textbooks as Keynesian economics, which is a really simple version of Keynes and deviates in really important ways and simplifies Keynes so that it becomes almost meaningless.
Well, the popular iteration of Keynesian economics is government infusion of capital into a business cycle. Is that kind of the theory, Dr. Hudson?
That's the theory, but at the time Keynes wrote in the 1930s, debt wasn't a problem. Keynes hoped that people would start to borrow again, and that the banks would create enough credit to supply enough demand for employment, or that the governments would borrow. That doesn't work today, because now the problem is too much debt. Now we're in almost the opposite problem of what it was in the Depression. People, after World War II, the economy was pretty much debt-free. Now we're debt overloaded, and that was a problem that Keynes simply didn't deal with in the general theory, but that's what we're dealing with today.
Did Keynes not deal with it, Bill Black, or could he have not foreseen the mess we're in today with the credit derivatives and the investment banks doing commercial business and having proprietary accounts and trading as well?
Well, nobody had a time machine to go forward.
Right.
And people 15 years ago, when the derivatives were starting, couldn't envision how incredibly they've transformed the world. So you can't go back to Keynes for, you know, like that there's supposed nuggets there that explain everything in the world. What Keynes was, though, was an observer of the world who thought in original ways and said, you know, a lot of these theories don't make sense and they don't predict well. Let's try to do better. And frankly, he had a whole lot better record in his ability to predict some of these disasters and others. And I think post-Keynesian really tries to pick up on that mindset as well.
Dr. Hudson, you had something to add?
Yes. In the 1920s, Keynes certainly did deal with debt, and he dealt with debt more than anybody else in his discussion of German reparations and inter-ally debts. The international debt was the great problem in the 1920s. And Keynes,
after World War I.
After World War I.
Right.
And Keynes was the first person to really outline and define the ability to pay foreign debt. And his analysis is still valid today. It's underlying all my analysis. But he turned turned away from this in the 30s after the debts were written down and there was a moratorium on inter-allied debt. Then the problem became almost a different phase of underemployment rather than the international debts. Keynes certainly knew about it. That wasn't the topic of the general theory.
And then right after that, of course, we had the worldwide depression of the 1930s.
Right.
So that set a whole new stage for what we're talking about today. Speaking of which, what types of things will be discussed at this post-Keynesian conference, Randall Ray?
Well, one of the enduring legacies of Keynes was the recognition that you can't rely on so-called free markets to resolve all problems. And so this is probably the most important contribution that Keynes made. We've gone through about a 30-year period where we've moved increasingly to just rely on markets. Let the market do everything. Let the market regulate itself. Let the banks supervise their own activities. We don't need any government regulation. Well, this, I think, has been thoroughly discredited now. And so there is a return to Keynes, which is sort of what this conference is about, getting back to the idea that free markets are actually not stabilizing, they're destabilizing.
UMKC has become pretty preeminent, as we've seen on this program and in other literature on your New Perspectives blogs and in your writings, as a sort of field of mavericky economics professors, economic mavericks. How did that happen, Bill Black?
Well, it happened well before I arrived. I only arrived 6 years ago, and this economics department has a distinct and very positive reputation that goes back a half century. And then it was built upon by Randy in particular, not just in the areas we've talked about, but also in another aspect of what Randy was talking about, and that is the paradox that Minsky talked about, that stability can lead to instability.
Not Minsky's pizza.
Not Minsky's pizza, but, you know, we can – I'm sure we can create an analogy there.
Right, right.
But the key thing was Alan Greenspan as an exemplar of the opposite view. So Alan Greenspan's thing was markets are self-correcting, that there's no such thing as an unregulated market because the market participants always are regulating it and always push it towards stability. Now, he wrote many of those things after he – absolutely knew that was untruthful because he was, after all, the leading expert for the leading frauds in the savings and loan crisis.
And he was also responsible for the Federal Reserve chief going pop, as it were.
Well, he was responsible
becoming
for
becoming the Pope of central bankers and being looked at as the
maestro.
The maestro.
The maestro,
right.
Is the, yes, the infamous sycophant work that praised his stuff, but didn't ask any hard questions about why had he not learned from working for the worst frauds during the savings and loan crisis, the markets, in fact, weren't inherently stable.
When I knew Alan Greenspan in the 1960s, he was a lobbyist for the banks. And so his idea of free markets was exactly the opposite of the classical idea. The classical idea was a market free from unearned income, free from landlords, free from exploitative banks, free from the idea was to bring prices in line with the actual cost value. For Alan Greenspan, it meant a market without government interference and deregulation. So Greenspan was in favor of a central planning much more than the socialists. Greenspan wanted to centralize planning in the banks, his clients. And so free market, Alan Greenspan style, is centralized planning by the banks. And their objective is very different from government planning. Instead of trying to promote employment and growth, they simply try to extract as much as they can from the economy. And that's the problem that we're left in today. The economy has been planned by the banks, and they're very predatory.
And I think some would argue that's what we're facing today. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. We have our economic outlaws with us. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. We have William Black, Randall Ray, and Michael Hudson, all UMKC professors of economics. This weekend, they're appearing at the 11th International Post-Keynesian Conference happening in downtown KC. There's also something happening here this weekend, Bill Black. Outlaw Economics 2.0. You see signs all up over campus and around town with the words Economics Outlaws. How did that come about? Do you see yourselves and your colleagues, Bill Black, Stephanie Keldon. Dr. Hudson here is outlaws to mainstream economic thinking.
Well, that came about because we have a sense of humor.
Right.
Which in itself makes us outlaws among economists who are not known for their sense of humor. But this is a play off Playboy, you know, that did a piece focusing on our department and put photos of Randy and myself, fortunately fully clothed, in the press. More seriously, as I said, there's a long tradition of University of Missouri Kansas City economics having a distinct viewpoint. And bluntly, there's a long tradition of having a whole lot better predictive record. Because a lot of this stuff that we've been talking about, these self-correcting markets, that didn't become just kind of important. That became the centerpiece of the efficient market hypothesis, which was everything in terms of modern finance. They built this whole structure and an economy measured in hundreds of trillions of dollars on a dogma, a religious dogma that had no truth to it. So in that sense, we're outlaws because we never drank that Kool-Aid and said, you know, markets are like that. We always said that's crazy and it's going to end disastrously.
And we'll have more details on the Outlaw Economics 2.0, a community teach-in, how to create jobs and save the middle class, September 28th and 29th at the UMKC Student Union. We'll have more details on that event, as well as the 11th International Post-Keynesian Conference happening in downtown KC on our website at kcur.org. Michael Hudson is new to our show, Central Standard, which has been talking about economic theory and monetary theory and fiscal policy for a while now with the UMKC economics professors. Michael Hudson, let's move over to your recent book, The Bubble and Beyond. Long subtitle, Fictitious Capital, Debt Deflation, and Global Crisis. Spell out the main premise of your book.
Well, the bubble was basically, for the first time in history, people thought they could get rich by running into debt. For the last 5,000 years, the idea is to stay away from debt. You don't mortgage the homestead. But people thought they could borrow. And the banks were lending money. And the money that they lent basically was used to bid up the price of housing, bid up stocks and bonds. So you had the biggest real estate boom, the biggest stock market boom, and an even bigger bond market boom in history, all financed by debt. And while people thought they were getting rich, the average share of homeownership in America fell from about 75% to now it's about 40%. The banks own most of the homes. So all of us, the result is when people have to pay the banks pay down the debts, they're not able to buy goods and services. The economy shrinks. And all of a sudden, when unemployment spreads, you have foreclosures, the bubble bursts, and the debts remain in place. And there's negative equity. That means people owe more than they can pay. And that's the situation we're in now. One quarter of American homeowners owe more money on their house than the property's worth. That's why so many people are walking away, which is just what Donald Trump would do or Goldman Sachs or any of the other people. But about 10 years ago in England, a banker said, we've made a breakthrough. We've discovered the poor are honest. In other words, unlike the rich, they believe they should repay their debts instead of looking at it as a game. And so the economy now has all of this debt overhead. People are repaying it, and that's why the economy is shrinking. It's the same situation that Keynes analyzed in the 1920s for German reparations. You have to either write down the debts, or as you're doing in Europe, you have a massive foreclosure and sell-off of government debt, foreclosure of private houses, and companies and whole cities and now going bankrupt.
What made you, as a former Wall Street fixed income or bond analyst, what made you want to make the switch to academia?
Somebody invited me to give a lecture at the New School on copper prices when I was analyzing commodities in the 1960s. And I'd never studied international economics in the PhD at NYU. And the only way to learn about economics is to teach it. So I only taught courses I didn't know anything about so that I'd have to learn about it. And found that, you have to deal with that arena in order to popularize the analysis that the economy is really in trouble.
So
should we all be teaching economics to learn more about economics?
I think the University of Missouri here is the only place where you can fit what's really important in the curriculum. I stopped teaching because I couldn't fit finance into the curriculum. They've sort of excluded the history of economic thought now. They've excluded economic history. So I actually joined the archaeology department at Harvard in 1984 because that's the only place I could fit debt in for the debt cancellations in Sumer, Babylonia, and all of the ancient society.
And maybe now you can dig up the bones and skeletons of that are in the bank in some of these banks.
That's right.
Let's go through a couple of central themes of your book: Fictitious Capital, Debt Deflation, and Global Crisis. And I want your colleagues Bill Black and Randall Ray to chime in where applicable. What is fictitious capital?
That's when the debt is larger than the amount that can be paid. Like right now, since 2008, the crisis, the federal government has bailed out banks with $13 trillion. It's created money not to finance the economy, but because all these bank claims were, there was huge overlending. The banks made liar's loans. They made loans without any regard for how much could be paid. So fictitious capital is where somebody has a savings or a bond, a claim on income that's way beyond the ability of the debtor to pay, and something has to give. There has to be a break there.
Randall Ray, expound on that fictitious capital.
Yeah. Well, it goes even beyond that, because what you have done is layered debt on debt on debt. So there are layers and layers on top of the real part of our economy that actually produces the goods and services and creates the income that we use. So on average in the United States, we have $5 of debt for every dollar of income. And so we have to service all of that out of our income. And this is why, as Michael says, spending is depressed, and why we can't get jobs created in the private sector, because they can't see enough sales. And the reason why they can't get the sales is because people are trying to service all this debt.
Which brings us to an interesting segue, the next prong, the next tranche on your premise in your book, if you will, debt deflation. How does debt deflation play into our economic outlook? We're a highly leveraged society. Debt deflation. What's that about, Bill Black?
Well, let's start with Michael.
Start back with Mike, and we'll go back to Bill Black.
Thesis.
Debt deflation.
Debt deflation is when people have to spend more and more of their income to pay the banks, and they have less and less income to spend on goods and services. And the bankers take what they collect in interest and fees and penalties. They don't spend on consumer goods. They don't buy the products of labor. They lend out yet more credit to indebt the economy all the more, and that's what the Fed is trying to do now. Spur more lending, as if somehow you can borrow your way out of debt, that's basically crazy. People don't have enough money to break even after they pay the bank.
And that's what the concept of debt deflation is about. It's not necessarily about deflation of the debt, but debt that leads to deflation?
It's a deflation of incomes. It means that what people have to spend after paying the bank, after paying the FICA, the Social Security and Medicare, after their take-home pay, they have less and less and less to spend. So it's a deflation of income, and that usually leads to a deflation of prices, certainly a deflation of what people can pay for housing, and that's why housing is so depressed now.
Bill Black, I threw it back to Dr. Hudson on that debt deflation question, but I know you know about this next area, this next tier of his general premise, and that is the words global crisis. Talk about that.
Well, it springs in large part from the first two subjects. So in criminology, we call the first one, the fictitious capital, accounting control fraud. And so it's an easy four-ingredient recipe. Grow like crazy by making really crappy loans at a premium interest rate with extreme leverage, that's the debt, and next to no loss reserves. If you do that, you'll produce record income, and then that flows through to the balance sheet. So it's real simple. Capital is assets minus liability. But if I inflate assets, then I report lots of capital. If the assets ain't real, then the capital isn't real, and that's what's happened. We didn't overvalue kind of a bit. we overvalued by 100%. In other words, stuff that was really worth 50 was going for 100. And when that collapses, you're going to get a massive financial crisis. When you get a massive financial crisis and a huge bubble like this collapsing, it's very common that you get a tremendously severe recession. And then to get out of it, this is what Michael and Randy have been talking about. If you just do business as usual, you twist slowly in the wind for years with very weak recovery, unless you get the government coming in to deal with the lack of demand in the private sector.
Quite simply, to address that question, let's look a bit at what's happening in Europe with Professor Hudson. When you have protests in Greece over austerity, when you have Spanish banks on the verge of being bailed out and unemployment figures higher in Spain since they've been in 1970s, which have a sort of reverberation over here. Simple question is, are we on the verge of a global financial crisis?
It's a crisis that the banks have been looking forward to and a crisis that the banks plan to get rich on. They're using the crisis, as Emmanuel Rahm would say, as an opportunity. And the opportunity is for massive privatization to turn democracy into oligarchy. Angela Merkel said that Greeks could not have a referendum.
Talking about the Chancellor of Germany.
Yes.
Just want to clarify that.
They could not have a referendum because they'd if you let democracy rule, the people will vote against paying the debts. And so Europe insisted in putting a technocrat in charge of Greece. A technocrat means a bank lobbyist. It means Alan Greenspan. It's a euphemism for turn over the government to the bank. So you've had a bank takeover of the governments in Greece and Spain and Latvia and Ireland. And the first thing
Italy.
The new governments do is break up the labor unions, sell off the public domain at very low prices. The plan is to lower wages. In Latvia, they cut government wages by 30%, hoping to that private sector wages would drive down also. They had one Latvian-owned bank that was the money laundering center. Latvia is a money laundering country. And
people were actually selling their souls for loans there at one point in time.
Indeed.
They really were, yeah.
And the bank they had dictators from all over, from Kazakhstan and places, putting their money in Latvia. The Latvians looted it, took the money for themselves, and so the government, which is run by the banks, took all of the bank debt onto the public balance sheet and made taxpayers pay. They could have simply monetized the debt and printed the money, but they used the crisis as an excuse to increase the taxes on labor. There's a 59% flat tax on employment in Latvia, higher than anywhere else in the world. One-third of the college-age population has emigrated in the last 5 years, and the same thing is happening in Greece. People are leaving Greece, emigrating. There's essentially the government is not paying to reinflate the economy. They're not paying to pump money into the economy. They're giving the money away to the banks. This is what in the past you needed an army to invade a country, to take over the land and the resources. And now, instead of a military invasion, instead of a Norman conquest, you're simply doing it financially without any military overhead. And in Greece and Spain, there are riots because they say, we're not going to let this happen. We've spent 500 years fighting off the Habsburgs, fighting off the other dictators. We're not going to let the banks do what the landlords, the medieval lords did in 5 centuries ago.
Are we going to have an economic battle of Hastings, as it were, Randall Ray?
Well, I think we're probably heading for another downturn and another global financial crisis, yes. This time it might well come out of Europe because they insist on imposing austerity. So they will, the ECB and the Bundesbank will agree to a little bit of financial help, but only if you take austerity. And
so
the problem is
cuts in government spending.
Cutting government spending, cutting wages, as Michael is talking about, and cutting employment. But what that does is just makes it impossible to service the debt.
Our guests are UMKC professors of economics William Black, Randall Ray, and Michael Hudson. And this weekend, they'll be at the 11th International Post-Keynesian Conference titled Reclaiming the Keynesian Revolution. That's happening at the downtown Marriott. Meanwhile, on campus, Outlaw Economics 2.0 is taking place, where they have one ukulele rhythm sections, outlaw economic workshops, banksters breaking the economy, and the son of a very famous economist, James K. Galbraith, saying simply, what is to be done? A lot of economics thought happening right here in KC, which is the epicenter of that this weekend. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we examine the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank's controversial quantitative easing policy, which is now in its third phase during this downturn. As we set up that discussion, we'd like to hear your theories on the Federal Reserve's monetary policy and questions about the Federal Reserve that you may have for our economics professors. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option, and our Twitter handle is @KCURCST. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Former Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank Chief Thomas Honig, who has long been critical of the larger policy of the Fed, said recently that banks could revert to risky policies if the commercial and investment bank divisions aren't split up as they were in the past. Now, Honig's replacement, Esther George, isn't too hot on the national Fed's policies either. She said recently that she was worried about market distortions caused by the Fed's policy of buying bank debt and pumping money into the financial system. To quote, she says, anytime you have the government this involved, you have to think something is not happening right. Right now, at zero interest rates, the markets aren't really pricing risk. They're not really functioning the way they normally would. We continue our discussion about the contrarian view of mainstream monetary policy that seems to start here in Kansas City. And speaking of our city, we'd love to hear your theories on the Federal Reserve's monetary policy and the questions about the Federal Reserve that you may have for our team of economic experts. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. Meanwhile, our guests are Bill Black, Randall Ray, and Michael Hudson, all professors of economics at UMKC. Randall Ray, the Federal Reserve has expanded its assets since 2007 from about, by some estimates, $800 billion to $3 trillion, according to some reports. What is the Fed doing with quantitative easing part three, its latest installment in the trilogy known as QE3?
Well, purportedly, the idea behind this is that if the Fed goes out and buys assets from banks, increases their reserves, this will push down the interest rate, and that will get people to borrow again. Now, there are two main problems with that, even if we take that at surface value. The first is, as Michael was saying, we don't really need people to go further into debt. They're already too far into debt. So that path to recovery is flawed because it means more indebtedness. The second problem with that story is that the Fed can lower the interest rate to zero without going out and buying $3 trillion worth of assets. The Fed knows how to do this. They meet almost every month at a FOMC meeting, and they decide what the interest rate will be. Period. That's all they need to do. Announce our target rate is now zero. And the markets will react to that and push the overnight interest rate to zero. So what are they really doing? Let me just one thing. And I think this is what the president is of the Kansas City Fed is getting to. They're now buying trashy mortgage-backed securities.
The ones we forgot about.
That's right. Moving the trash off the balance sheets of banks. And I think this is worrying, not just because it means the Fed is going to absorb losses in the future, because it can afford to absorb them after all, but what does that mean for economic policy? What kinds of incentives and rewards are we given to banks that made really trashy loans, and now we move those loans onto the books of the Fed?
You're doing a panel discussion presenting the results of one of your Ford-funded projects. It's called, this is a big one, and it's along the lines of what we're talking about, Transparency and Accountability of the Fed. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's exactly this issue right here. The Fed actually, it's much more than what Michael said. The Fed had to lend $29 trillion to bail out Wall Street. And we talked about that on your show before. And so the first phase of our study was to actually do all the accounting, account for every single loan the Fed made to banks in order to bail them out. And it totals to $29 trillion. So that in itself raises issues. Should the government really be in this business of bailing out banks that made really tremendous mistakes? But it was all done behind closed doors. That's the democracy, accountability, and governance issue. The Fed even refused to tell Congress what they had done after they did it. It wasn't just a matter that they didn't consult Congress. Do you think it's a good idea for us to lend $29 trillion to bail out Wall Street? They wouldn't even tell them what they did after the fact. It took a Freedom of Information lawsuit to get this data out of them.
Is there anything in your findings that surprised you about the Federal Reserve and monetary policy that you didn't know?
Well, I think the surprising thing was, first, how big it was, many orders of magnitude bigger than what anyone suspected. Second, it was the same sort of serial abusers. A handful of banks accounted for the vast majority of these funds. And third, the Fed provided loans at extremely low interest rates to these banks for periods of up to 2 years. And if you think about that, what it means is that the government is essentially subsidizing the banks by giving them extremely cheap money to finance their positions in assets.
Michael Hudson, the caveat here, though, is that the Federal Reserve is technically not the government. Many of its most ardent critics say that it's about as Federal Express. So how do we deal with that?
Well, I think that's a red herring, although technically the stock in the Federal Reserve is owned by the private banks. The government is actually in charge of appointing the Fed officers. The problem is that the banks own the government, not that they own the Federal Reserve. They have veto power over whoever's put in. And actually, the situation is much worse than Randy says. Randy's talked about what the Fed did wrong, but let's look at what happened to the money that the Fed gave to the banks. Quantitative easing, too, was $800 billion. The promise was that the banks would now have enough money to lend out more mortgages, and people could bid up the price of housing so that people had to spend even more to buy a home, so that the banks would be out of their balance sheet problems. In fact, what the banks did, the entire $800 billion was lent abroad. It was used for arbitrage speculation, where you could borrow from the Fed at 0.25%, and you could lend to Brazil, say, at 11%, and pocket the difference for yourself and earn your way out of debt. And the banks, by sending the money abroad, pushed up the value of the Brazilian currency so that they got a foreign exchange benefit as well as an interest rate arbitrage. So they made money by gambling abroad. None of this money went into the U.S. economy. It was to enable the banks to lend abroad. And we found out much of the logic a few days ago. Sheila Bair, the head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, just published her expose of what happened, and she's very angry, and you got to read the book. She said all this money, all this bailout, that TARP bailout and the others, was done for one purpose, to save Citibank and the crooked organizations. She spoke a week ago at the alternate banking Occupy Wall Street group in New York, and she said the financial system has been criminalized, and that she tried to take over Citibank, that she could not, that Geithner, the bank lobbyist, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, refused to take over Citibank or the other banks that were had been criminalized, because she said nobody could distinguish Citibank from Citicorp. They were so interwoven in what she describes as a criminal organization that she was powerless, and people refused to follow what she did and only did what the banks told them. She described how Geithner was on the phone constantly with Citibank saying, well, you have to make Chase Manhattan borrow and all the other less insolvent banks borrow just as an excuse to save Citibank. So that all of this huge inverted pyramid was all to save the crooks at the center of the system at Citibank, Bank of America, Countrywide Financial, and the organizations that Bill Black has talked about so much.
By the way, you mentioned Chase Manhattan. It's now J.P. Morgan Chase, probably about two mergers ago. It's even bigger than
it was. My habit.
Now.
I used to work for them as their balance
payments. Right. We're going to go to Heather and Gardner. We're harboring economic outlaws here in the studio on Central Standard. We have Bill Black, Randall Ray, and Michael Hudson, all economics professors at UMKC. Heather and Gardner, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. Let me preface this question with a statement that I am not a Ron Paul supporter. but the more I learn about the Fed, the more I understand why people want to get rid of it so badly. And I had no idea it was essentially basically a private organization. If our own government can't control or change the Fed and the big banks and all this, it feels like it leaves people no choice but to go, gosh, I hate to say this, but like almost violent revolution, because electing people isn't going to do anything. So what is the choices here, and why can't we get rid of the Fed or reform these banks that are controlling every one of our lives? And I'll take my answer off air. Thank you.
A very complex question for very complex times. And let me preface this by saying, to be fair, it's easy to talk about ending something such as the Federal Reserve if you feel the economy isn't improving and you're looking at what's on the brink of disaster. But what would you put in place, economics panelists, for central banking and potential backstopping for these catastrophic losses, or some sort of centralized thing? Aren't we already all in? What would ending the Fed really do?
Well, ending the Fed actually in this crisis at various stages could have been catastrophic. So it is true that literally thousands of financial markets were seizing up globally. And somebody had to exist to get liquidity into
right.
the system. The European Central Bank was set up in a way that it couldn't do so and wouldn't do so. And so you would have had a complete collapse of much of the European economy but for the Federal Reserve. So I don't think the issue is so much that central banks shouldn't exist or that they shouldn't have the ability to be a lender of last resort, but they should be an intelligent lender of last resort as opposed to a tool of the banks. And they're not going to be, as long as you have an institutional structure set up where they're a tool. But I want to strongly endorse Michael's point. Too much focus on the Fed being controlled by the banks and not enough on the administrations and the Treasury. So Honig's point, let me show you how radical the world has become.
Talking about Thomas Honig, the former Fed chief of Kansas
right.
City.
Right. So Thomas Honig, I was there in a group of 20 when he said this, and he was in all seriousness. He says, we pick our Treasury Secretary in the United States by holding an auction, and of late Goldman Sachs has been winning it. Right. That is the view of a conservative Republican. Sheila Bair, a conservative Republican. Neil Barofsky, a conservative, you know, sort of independent type. All of these people have come out of this experience saying the big banks. I was on with Cato, who said yesterday, you know, Cato.
The Cato Institute, not Cato Kaelin OJ's.
Right, this is the ultra-right wing folks
right.
saying the big banks dominate government and there's no such thing as free markets. These are completely rigged markets. They're rigged to bring the money, as Michael has said, to finance, which now gets an incredible percentage of total profits in America. So something that's supposed to be just a middleman, and where the efficiency condition is lean and mean, small, has become enormous.
Brett in Lee Summit, welcome to Central Standard.
Oh, okay. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like at the end of this for you guys to maybe give us some solutions. I haven't really heard any.
Well, they can give them to you now.
Okay, real quick. I got a couple of points I make, like, if I could.
Go ahead.
I'm hearing banks are at the root of all this, and rich people are all the root of all this. I think the politicians get a pass. And that's sickening, because if you think the banks are driving this, it's only because the politicians are allowing them. because they get theirs, and we hold, we keep demonizing this, you know, this nebulous bank. You know, I need to give some examples, but do you think that could go on without the politicians looking the other way because they get their contributions? I mean, it's we need to really have the media go after and find out what is the relationship between the politicians and the bank. Why did Citicorp do what they did? Why were they allowed to do what they did? Well, the politicians, we know they are in place and there's regulations of the politicians to run this game, but they choose not to, or they play loose with the game because they know they benefit from it. So thank you for letting me vent. And if you could just give a few more solutions, I would love it.
Thank you, Brett. And if you had been listening and will continue to listen, Bill Black simply made the point that we can't let the administration and the cabinet officials and the Treasury and Obama, Bush, whoever, off the hook. By the way, personal plug for the show, I have a interview with Bill Black where we talk about the revolving door of bankers and bank interests going into Treasury and coming back out and how it sort of caused this continual financial malaise that we've seen over the past two decades or so. So thank you for your comments, Brett. Michael Hudson, you had something to say.
You've put your finger on the problem. Politicians and elections have been financialized and put up for auction. Not only since Citizens United are campaign corporations allowed to give to the election campaigns of politicians, but in Congress, in order to become head of any congressional committee, you have to give the Democratic National Committee $1 million in campaign contributions. Now, that means that the politicians who can raise the most money can give the Democratic National Committee enough money to become head of the Finance Committee, the banking committees, and the others. And so the banks decide, who do we want to give our money to who will represent us? So the banks give the money to politicians who serve them, and the job that turns politics into the job of getting elected and delivering your voters, your constituents, to your campaign contributors. So that's part of the result of putting elections up for auction. The banks have taken over the political process just as they've taken over the regulatory process to put deregulators in charge.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. A very lively economic discussion as we usually have here on Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall, with our economic outlaws, Bill Black, Randall Ray, and Michael Hudson, all UMKC professors of economics. Through Saturday, they'll be making appearances at the 11th International Post-Keynesian Conference titled Reclaiming the Keynesian Revolution. And we also have Outlaw Economics 2.0 with a community teach-in on how to create jobs and save the middle class with Bill Black, James K. Galbraith, among others. Lots going on this weekend. Lots going on in this discussion. Just real quickly.
Solutions.
Solutions. Well, right.
Have a jobs guarantee program funded by the federal government, run through government, but also through NGOs. Two, increase the stimulus. Three, bring back revenue sharing as part of the stimulus bill. The states and localities are being crushed because they cannot borrow in these circumstances. Revenue sharing is the obvious answer to those things. Four, bring back real regulation. Simply pass a law that the Commodities Future Modernization Act is repealed. The Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which eliminated Glass-Steagall, which you were talking about at the lead into the is hereby repealed. That we bring back the underwriting rules, which are really simple and prevent many of the worst loans. That we get rid of the hypervelocity trading and that we dramatically reduce derivatives and crack down on speculation in the derivatives.
Michael Hudson, keys to recovery real quickly as we want to get back to some of the callers and Randall Ray, of course.
I agree with everything Bill Black said. One of the things that Sheila Bair recommended is that there's a rule that if you work for the government as a regulator or administrator, you are not allowed to go to work for the financial sector. It's what the Japanese call a descent from heaven. Right now, the regulators and the government officials will serve the banks, just like the head of Citibank did, Robert Rubin, who pushed as Undersecretary of the Treasury Missouri put forth the repeal of many laws, and then went to work as head of Citibank, descent from heaven, became many, many million dollars per year. You've got to make that illegal.
Can I add?
Yeah, please.
One thing. I also agree with everything that they've said. Many of the things that Bill mentioned require Congress to go along. And so people say, well, but how are you ever going to get that through Congress? And that is a huge problem right now. There's one thing that can be done immediately by the president. Fire Eric Holder, get an attorney general who will actually prosecute the banksters. All it takes is five convictions, one at each of the top banks, and those banks will be shut down. They can't survive that.
Tall orders, all of these, but things that can be done if there's a will. There's certainly a way. There needs to be a will. Gary in Midtown, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. I've wondered for the panel if they agree with me that the Wall Street bailout was a giant transfer of cash from about 430 congressional districts to about five congressional districts in this country that was prompted by the credit default crisis. And the districts that benefited are where Wall Street sits, where the corporations exist, and where the corporate leaders live. I feel like we've been bailing them out for too long. And I also had the related question is, do they feel that failure to reform Wall Street was one of the biggest failures of the Obama administration, given that the Republicans are unlikely to lead and agitate for useful change? I'll take my answer off the air.
Very interesting questions. Very fair questions. Go ahead, Randall Ray.
Yeah, he hit all of them. All of those are absolutely true. And, you know, we're seeing the evidence that this is the biggest transfer of wealth to the top 0.1% the world has ever seen. And so, yes, exactly. Bailing out the people who caused the mess, it essentially allowed them to push the reset button, start again, doing exactly what they were doing before with all the derivatives. But on top of that, we're moving the real wealth, the houses, to the top 0.1%. We've got hedge funds that are buying up blocks of houses now.
What are scenarios for recovery, Mike Hudson?
There can't be a recovery until you write down the debt to the ability to pay. President Obama promised to do this, but it was an empty promise. And he did what his campaign contributors wanted him to do, not what he promised to do. Without writing down the debt, the homeowners and businesses and states and localities are going to have to pay more than they can afford to pay. So we're living in a fictitious world. We're living in a world as if they can pay the debt, and they can't pay. And the price of paying the debt is going to be a prolonged depression. The current government policy is to impose a lost decade on America, just like Japan had a lost decade when it did not write down its debt.
But Europe is worse. Europe, with its adoption of austerity, has thrown, on average, the entire eurozone back into recession. Greece and Spain are in actual depression levels with over 25% unemployment and youth unemployment of 50%. So the incredible battle is about to be within the Democratic Party if Obama wins, because there are strong suggestions that Bowles would be made the new Treasury Secretary, and he would try to implement an austerity program as stupid as the European austerity program at the worst conceivable time and cause an absolute catastrophe.
In a related story, we have a show this week about a man who quit spending money and now lives in a cave in Utah. So that's a related story that you can also check out on KCUR.org as we hear some of the arduous economic climate that we have today and that we face going forward. Jim in Lee Summit, or excuse me, Julie in Poganoxie. Welcome to Central Standard.
Yes. Gentlemen, I didn't realize I could possibly be made any more depressed than I already
right,
am.
Right, right, right.
I just finished the very excellent book Web of Debt by Ellen Hudson Brown, and I would be most interested to hear your comments on her. Please don't tell me she's a psychotic like Ayn Rand or something like that. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Web of Debt. Has anybody heard of this tome?
Yes. Ellen's a friend of mine. She is a lawyer. Very few lawyers understand very much about economics or debt, but it's a good introductory book for the debt problem.
You're a lawyer that knows a little bit about debt and economics.
I'm Bill a Black. Recovering litigator.
About you, Randall.
Yeah, we've had Ellen at UMKC to give a lecture. Very interesting. She can tell you the whole Wizard of Oz story, what that actually was all about, which was debt. She makes a lot of good points. She's also pushing for public banks to replace these private for-profit and, in many cases, criminal bank activities.
We have a question from a student at UMKC on the UMKC campus for his professors. Welcome to Central Standard. Sam?
Thank you. This is a great topic to talk about. My question is, when did all this started, you know, going back to history? When did, you know, the strong relationship between the Fed and the bank started?
That's a long story with
Well, that's easy.
Another show.
From the beginning.
Back to Jekyll Island.
Yeah.
Well, the Fed was created after a financial crisis to resolve this problem. But as Bill said before, you have to have a central bank. Central banks do serve some useful functions. The problem is that the Fed is far too focused on assisting banks rather than in performing in the interests of the country as a whole.
Final thoughts, Michael Hudson, as we wrap up.
When the Fed was created, it was created under the Democrats after the 1907 crash. There was a National Monetary Commission looking at what kind of banking system we should have. It was done by the Republicans. The National Monetary Commission said what we want to do is create a banking system that lends to industry like the German banks. Most of the volumes were all in the German banks. And Germany and Central Europe did have a banking system that took equity shares, that didn't just load down the economy with debt by lending against assets already in place, but lend for the creation of assets. That's not how the Fed was done, so the Fed was malstructured from the outset.
Bill Black, really quickly, what would John Maynard Keynes think of the current economic crisis?
He would think of what he warned at that time, that conservative economists think that there is virtue in people suffering. And that is one of the most insane aspects. And you saw that again in Romney's secretly videotaped speech.
Our guests are Bill Black, Randall Ray, and Michael Hudson, UMKC professors of economics. The University of Missouri Kansas City Department of Economics will host the 11th International Post-Keynesian Conference, Reclaiming the Keynesian Revolution, beginning September 27th through September 29th. At the Kansas City downtown Marriott. Also, Outlaw Economics 2.0, a community teaching how to create jobs and save the middle class, will be on the UMKC campus. Lots going on this weekend to feed your inner econ geek. Bill Black, Randall Ray, and Michael Hudson, thank you for coming to Central Standard.
Thank you.
And tune in tomorrow for Monroe Dodd, who looks beyond Truman Capote's masterpiece with a book from a local author titled Beyond Cold Blood. Our show is produced by Tamika Weatherspoon, executive produced by Bill Anderson. Kim Noble is our announcer, with special thanks to Michael Byers, who's behind the boards today. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney. The outro you're hearing right now is by the Wilnots. Up to Date is next with a look at the Clinton presidency from historian William Chafee. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.